Hello, welcome to another episode of The Lancet Voice. We're addressing the biggest topics surrounding COVID-19 as Europe goes into another round of lockdowns. I'm Gavin Cleaver.
And I'm Jessamy Baganon. One of the biggest questions of the last few months for us has been the failure of test and trace systems across much of Europe, the US. Lots of countries have really struggled with this to effectively control the virus. I spoke with Rosanna Peeling, who we've spoken to before. She's the director of the International Diagnostics Centre and chair of diagnostics research at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, to discuss why testing in particular hasn't been able to avert lockdowns and how it might be fixed. Rosanna, thanks so much for joining us again. I was just looking back at the last sort of 7-8 months and I saw the opening remarks from the Director General of the WHO from March 16th, 2020, which basically says, you know, we're concerned that countries are not sort of ramping up their testing capacity, and we have one simple message for all countries: test, test, test. Why is it that, you know, 7 months later, this seems to be so poorly done in many countries?
That's actually a hugely important question. I think all the countries would like to have a better capacity to doing testing, but scaling up of molecular testing is a really difficult thing, because molecular tests to detect the viral RNA is quite a complex procedure. And so you, to begin with, you need to have the lab capacity with the technical expertise and competence, you know, staff to do the work. And to build that capacity is not something you could do overnight, right? And then you need the supplies and the reagents, and there's a global competition for supplies and even for swabs, right? And then a lot of countries are having a few testing centers where the testing is done, and the specimens have to be transported from all different clinics, hospitals to the testing center. So that causes delay, specimens are lost, etc. So the specimen transport system is something new that countries have to set up de novo for the pandemic response. And of course, there are different problems that countries encounter. And then finally, getting the results back to the patient in a timely manner from the lab, from the central testing lab services to all the different clinics, to the providers, to the patients, etc. That has been really difficult. And so these are very sort of basic pandemic preparedness, basics. But it's a lot of countries thought they are prepared, but are not quite, because I don't think we ever thought it would become a pandemic of this scale. And so.
Right. And what is the relationship between contact tracing and testing? And why are they hard to combine, or why are countries struggling to combine them?
Yeah, I think, contact tracing is one of the, you know, traditional key public health measures to either slow down or stop or interrupt spread of an infection in the communities. We do this all the time for sexually transmitted diseases like HIV, chlamydia, gonorrhea, etc., right? But in most countries, they have only few people trained for contact tracing. Because it does require some skills, and you really need to be able to train people to say, okay, you know, how do you trace the contacts of a confirmed case? What do you ask about symptoms? What do you ask about activities and travel before you tested positive? And then how to reach all the people that you may be in contact with? And what if they were in a shopping center? And, you know, how wide is the net that you want to do? So there's a problem of, just for contact tracing alone, of human resources, not enough people trained to do that, and also not having an international standard on sort of the, or national standard on the rules of, you know, how wide a net, how fast, how, you know, detailed you want to be. And then once you track down someone, are you going to offer testing? How are you going to offer testing to them so that you would know whether they're infected or not, or whether you just tell them to self-isolate for 14 days or all that. And so countries have started to try to innovate. I think in Singapore, they started to utilize other people who are trained in tracking down, you know, sort of detective type work outside of health to try and help, which is very useful. And then other countries are using apps, right? Have electronic systems where people could find out if they have been near anywhere near a case. But of course, you know, that comes with a lot of sort of privacy issues and whether people are willing to be identified. I think in some countries, they identify the street where people have become positive, or in Canada, for example, they give the data by region. In a city, so you section of the city, whether you have higher number of positives or not, but that doesn't help you. I think sometimes they broadcast memos like there's been a case at a shopping center or a case at, you know, some mass gathering or something. So it's not something that you apply to most sort of disease control work. So that's something, you know, again, as part of pandemic preparedness, we should be better prepared for the future.
And is that kind of failure to be able to sort of combine those contact tracing and testing effectively? You know, one of the major reasons that many well-resourced countries have, you know, sort of responded to the pandemic fairly poorly, or are there lots of other issues going on at play?
I think the most difficult thing for a country is that if they started to lock down or travel restrictions late, and when they first test, they already have a huge number of cases, then it's beyond the capability of the country to trace down everyone, right? Whereas if they started the lockdown earlier, like in some countries in Asia that had, you know, had the scare of what happened with SARS, they started earlier, they get on top of every single case and not let it go through without the contact tracing, then it's manageable. But when it becomes, you know, a certain number, maybe it won't be manageable.
And I guess that's where this sort of question about elimination versus suppression comes in. Where do you sit on that debate and sort of conversation?
I think there are a lot of factors to think about suppression or elimination, and there's no easy answer. And I think that a few countries decided that maybe they won't try to suppress. They would just let people go on their everyday lives and detect the cases, try and do public health measures as much as possible, and let it run through the course. But we know now that could lead to quite a chaotic situation, right? And there has to be a sort of a happy medium between the two. And I think countries like Singapore and other countries now, South Korea, they have these circuit breakers. So you and circuit breakers are very good in a way that if people know that from, you know, next Saturday for 3 weeks we're in a lockdown situation, then they could plan for it, right? And they are much more likely to be compliant with it than if you just say, okay, we're locked down now. And there's no telling when. And I remember, in some countries when they imposed lockdown, there was just no way that people will comply because they thought, well, you know, how are they going to make a living? And if they don't comply, then, you know, nothing. Then all the public health measures are not effective because we always say, you know, no one is safe until everyone is safe. And so if there's a one part of the community where people are not complying, then the whole community is at risk.
And which countries who you know, did not have a collective memory of SARS have done well to develop their testing and contact tracing capacity? And what might other countries that are struggling with their current testing sort of levels learn from them?
Well, I would say that in Europe, Germany has been, you know, doing really well in terms of their ability to cope with the pandemic. I think they started containment efforts quite early when they see the surge of number of cases in Italy and in Spain, right? And so there was widespread testing. They have lots of hospital and intensive care beds, so they were able to cope with the patient load. But I think more importantly is that the public complied with the recommended measures. And also, I think that people have to trust the government. And so otherwise, your public communications messages are not effective if people don't trust the government. So transparency, people like to know that the government is telling them the truth about what's happening and not hiding anything. And that's, you know, to gain public trust is difficult in a pandemic situation where you're trying to learn about the virus as you go. And so you may have to change policy because of new learnings. Like, you know, when we first learned that people could be shedding virus before they become symptomatic, I mean, that changed everything about what we say about masks, about gatherings and all that. And so the public have to trust that the government is not just telling them a story, but that, you know, so I think Germany did really well, I think. And the other country that has done well and not being part of the SARS, having had a SARS memory, is Senegal in Africa. So I think that Senegal had a different kind of memory, which was Ebola. And so there was a threat of an Ebola outbreak in 2014. And from there, they actually have a national blueprint on what to do about an outbreak, and that they applied because it's a smaller country, so it's easier to apply. And also they have mobile labs. They have lots of testing capacity as well as mobile labs to make sure nobody is left behind. And so that is a success. Yeah, the testing capacity, you know, the government being prepared and the public trusting. Yeah. So.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because that kind of, you know, the public health messaging in so many countries has been so poor, and obviously it's difficult for, you know, people in society to understand that things might change and that nothing's kind of so clear cut. But I think also that there does seem to be a kind of, even the fact that, you know, there have been politicians within different countries that have been questioning the role of the state within public health is also very unhelpful, when actually, you know, historically the role of the state within public health is very fixed and has a very good history in terms of dealing with both, you know, mass vaccination, reducing road traffic accidents, all of these kind of things where, you know, there's been state intervention to improve public health. And this kind of political sort of uncertainty that certain politicians have been propagating seems to really undermine that and to make everybody feel a lot more uncertain.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, there are three parties and you know, there's the public, there's the public health and the scientists, and then there's the politicians, right? And so I think that there has to be a seamless sort of a sense of community that we're all trying to do this together before it could, yeah. The countries where we've seen failures in the response are countries that where the politicians don't trust the scientists or don't take advice from the scientists, or they actually, you know, sort of try to balance the economy in a way that is not good for public health in terms of control of the pandemic, and in doing so, actually made it worse for both the economy and the disease control. And you know, we have some examples of some really well-resourced countries that have gone that route. And with the public now completely bewildered as to who they should trust, whether it's the voice of science and or the voice of the politician, and the public, of course, wants the economy to recover. And so then, you know, it throws all three parties that are so important in the pandemic response into disarray.
And just out of interest, Rosanna, what's that been like as a scientist, being on these various panels, doing things? I mean, it must be quite emotionally challenging in many ways.
It is, because you're always trying to balance what's ideal in terms of the science with the reality. And the reality is more than just the biomedical intervention, right? There's the public. There's a global competition of supplies, and there's global competition for everything. And so in terms of thinking about equitable access for testing, for example, and trying to recommend whether we should have a test that has this type of accuracy and this type of usability, it's all in vain if countries cannot get access to it. Right. So on the one hand, you know, having these recommendations that and the recommendations actually take weeks and months to make, it's taking way too long. We should be just a little bit more pragmatic about the whole thing and just keep changing as we know more. Right. But people don't work like that. Systems don't work like that. Right. And so we just learn to be more nimble, faster, and not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I think this pandemic has been a major teachable moment for us on how to, you know, make policy or how to move things a lot faster to control the situation.
Yeah, but it must be extremely emotionally wearing and challenging for you in that position, trying to juggle all of those things and also just sort of the responsibility.
Yeah, and also, you know, and have friends phone up and said, you know, why is it that my dollars cannot buy these tests versus dollars from the US and UK and Canada? So there's all kinds of inequities that are really at play here when it comes to, you know, a pandemic.
And what do you think we can expect in terms of improvements in testing capabilities and availability in technology and who can get it, who can access it over the next 6 months? You know, we've talked a little bit about the sort of bottlenecks, but what are those bottlenecks that really need to be overcome over the winter months, you know, in the global north anyway?
So I think in terms of testing, I'm so envious of the vaccine groups. The vaccine groups are already talking about major fair allocation mechanisms and, you know, being prepared for trials and everything. For diagnostics, we have over 580 some brands of diagnostics that are waiting to be evaluated. We have, you know, we don't recommend people buy them before we know whether they work or not. And then the supply chain, you know, all the good tests, once the publication came out that they're good, there's a big competition for those, right? And countries are being caught with different, I guess, you know, the U.S. are not allowed, U.S. companies are not allowed to export any until the U.S. market's filled. And, you know, so there are many of these things that are difficult. And then still countries are not moving as quickly as possible because the regulators and the policymakers are still asking the companies to do evaluations in their countries. So one product, one rapid test that was really good, the company told me, we're being asked by 40 countries to do trials in their country. And so this is slowing down and the time for access for the people. And also it's actually a huge cost to the company. So the final cost of goods would be a lot higher then if we had streamlined all that and we have major convergence or reliance of this kind of information on how good the tests are, rather than every country demanding to have their own trial. So there are lots of these bottlenecks that we need to figure out on supply. And then the other bottleneck is for everybody to come to a consensus on how to use them, where to use them. We have now the very sophisticated molecular tests. We have the point of care molecular tests. We have the rapid antigen tests to detect viral proteins. We have antibody tests. Some can just detect total antibodies. Some can detect antibodies that may be neutralizing. You know, so we have this whole portfolio of tests, and as I said, over 500 of them. Countries need some guidance, or they could figure out and share with other countries how they intend to use them and where to use them, who to use them on. For example, you know, if you use the rapid antigen test at border crossings, when your expected number of positives are low, you're going to get more false positives than real positives, even if the specificity is very high. And so, you know, I think that countries need to be very careful about how they use these tests. And unfortunately, it's not an easy thing to do. And
I think what I really got from the Rosanna interview is that so much of the kind of conversation about test and trace that's dominated the media generally kind of lacks those nuances that Rosanna got across. You know, that in European countries, for example, we allow the virus to spread too widely for anything approaching a comprehensive test and trace system to kind of pat it back down, whereas the more successful countries got on top of it early, and in that case the testing and tracing systems didn't have to cover so many cases and could obviously work a lot more efficiently. Now, that seems obvious when you talk about it, this kind of exponential nature of the resources needed for a testing and tracing system in relation to the number of cases they're monitoring. But it's not something you see much of a discussion of in the news generally.
Yes, I think that's true. And that sort of, you know, reasonable expectations of how can you reasonably expect a contact tracing system to be, you know, doing the contact traces of thousands and thousands of cases is a narrative that we don't very much discuss. And I think that that's something that came across clearly with Germany when they were considering going into lockdown, about their reasons of going into lockdown now, or, you know, last week or in the last week or so, was to try and get those numbers in control so that they could then rely again on their contact trace system. I think the other thing that really came across for me from that interview was just how many tests there are and how important it is to get this right. Because, you know, even when we have a vaccine, people are still going to need to be tested. We're still going to be heavily reliant on understanding who is infected, where they're infected, you know, where the transmission is. And we really need to focus on that as much as we're focusing on therapeutics, as much as we're focusing on vaccines. And we're not at the moment. It's certainly not something that we hear lots and lots about, other than, oh, we can't get our contact tracing system, you know, going.
Yes, it almost feels like kind of phase two of testing is to finally start identifying the asymptomatic patients. You know, that cases have been so widespread across Europe that we never really got as far as working out who were the asymptomatic, the walking well, I guess. And it was more a case of putting the resources to where they were needed right now, which was people who were on well. But actually, to get to the next stage of the epidemic, we're going to need to identify those asymptomatic patients and isolate them as well.
Well, yes, I mean, it's incredibly hard because obviously, you know, there's been a sort of range of estimations of how many people are asymptomatic. I mean, we've seen studies from 20% to 60%, and that will change across age groups. So, you know, this is a sort of something that's been developing over the last couple of months. And I think there has also been this focus on trying to get the most accurate tests. And that's where I think that Rosanna's suggestion, and I think it's something that's coming through more and more, particularly as we see Liverpool doing mass testing, is that actually what's clear is that in many countries, contact tracing, the way we're trying to do it at the moment, is not working. and we need to try something else. And that might be then trying different tests that are potentially, you know, not quite so precise, but allow a much more frequent testing, are easier to do, and can give us some kind of ability to, you know, get a handle on things quickly.
I feel like you're dancing around the word moonshot here without actually using it.
I can't use the word moonshot. I mean, we'd have to use warp speed, you know, all of these aeronautical terms would have to come into play.
I do think as well, one thing that I've always been keen to point out to people that ask me generally about, you know, testing system, what's gone wrong in Europe, is that Europe generally feels less likely to accept the kind of authoritative measures that have been put in place by Eastern governments in relation to quarantine and kind of taking people out of society. And I was reminded of this recently, of, as you were mentioning, Liverpool there, I was reminded of Slovakia. And what they've done in Slovakia with testing the whole country is said that you can refuse the test if you want, but if you refuse the test, you have to quarantine and you can't go to work. So those are the kind of methods where it's skirting more towards the kind of authoritative government measures, I think, in the East that you just don't see generally in European governments. But I think it'll be interesting to see once we have an extremely comprehensive testing system that can test entire cities or entire countries in a matter of days, along with the vaccine, to what extent governments then kind of, I want to say, push their luck on that level. But yes, you know what I mean.
I do. I mean, I do think it's interesting because I think that this sort of concept of the state involvement in public health and how in European countries, you know, it's sort of hands off is not really fair. I mean, even, you know, just looking back over the last 70 years, for instance, in the UK, there were things called fever vans where, you know, children who had scarlet fever were literally taken in these fever vans from their family and put into hospital, and their family weren't allowed to see them again. I feel that we have lost any sense of a collective memory of what it's like to deal with an infectious disease on a large scale. You know, in fact, governments have been forever trying to make their population safe from infectious diseases with some, you know, pretty involved measures, you know, and that's that sort of precedent is very much set and one that I struggle to see quite why it's such an issue at the moment.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think the topic of collective memory is a really interesting one. When we spoke a few episodes ago with Kenji Shibuya about the response in Japan, that was one of the things that he spoke quite a lot about, was the collective memory of the recent SARS and MERS outbreaks in the East, and how mask wearing was this kind of thing that had been going on for so long in Japan that it was kind of a completely accepted normal part of everyday life now, whereas countries like the UK are just kind of coming to this now, these kind of developing this memory, I suppose, developing an idea of how we a memory of how we deal with this sort of pandemic. So yes, I do think that collective memory is a really, really important part. But I also do think that kind of mask wearing and adherence to these kind of measures is improving in the UK as we go on, as it becomes more of a normal part of our lives.
Definitely. And I suppose it is just that balance of, you know, there's so much economic difficulty that is associated with coronavirus, particularly for people who are in informal labour or aren't covered by some of these job schemes. We have to make that much, much better, because that's the only way that you can really expect people to be adhering to some of these guidelines and to be, you know, willing to be tested, to be really trying to use their contact tracing apps, is if they are able economically and safely to follow the rules after they test positive. Otherwise, it's all for nothing.
Yes, yes. Making the imposition as convenient as possible, so to speak. Another major question has been the logic behind keeping schools open while other preventative measures are in place. How big are the risks? How can we stop children falling behind? What's current best practice for keeping schools open? Jessamy spoke with Melinda Bunton, who's the Chair of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University, to talk generally about schools and COVID-19.
Melinda, thanks so much for talking with us. Perhaps you might start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
So after I earned my PhD, I went to work for sort of the original think tank, RAND Corporation, which was a nonpartisan organization. And I did research as part of big teams there about things like how to pay rehabilitation hospitals and what's the effect of high healthcare costs on U.S. competitiveness. And from there, I went to the multi-billion dollar initiative to upgrade health IT in the U.S. And from there to the Congressional Budget Office, which gives nonpartisan advice to the U.S. Congress about the costs and other implications of each piece of legislation they're considering. And from there, I went to Vanderbilt, where I'm part of a major academic medical center. So I've really been able to see all sides of health policy and all sides of the U.S. healthcare system, executive branch, legislative branch, nonprofit think tank, and now clinical operations.
Exactly. And that's what's really struck me when I was reading your bio, is that you must have such a kind of in-depth view of all these different aspects of healthcare in the US, which, you know, particularly now seems to be a pretty good skill set to have.
Well, healthcare is so complicated that no one can have a truly in-depth view of what's going on in nearly 20% of the economy. But I can say I've had a number of different vantage points, and that does help me.
Yeah, no, that's great. And today you're going to talk to us a little bit about schools and children, transmission of COVID-19. And I thought we might start by just sort of talking about where our understanding of the role that children play in transmitting flu and other coronaviruses comes from, and what that kind of meant for how we thought about the initial responses to school closures.
Absolutely. It's such a great question. I mean, I do think that the initial response of school closures was based in the best information we had at the time. So we know from prior research that children are often key transmitters of diseases like influenza because they spend prolonged time in close contact with other children. They do sports, things like that. And even prior studies had identified associations between school closures and reduced transmission, again, of diseases like influenza. So it was logical to think that we should close schools initially. However, what we're learning now is that, as we gain experience, is that there are mitigation strategies that do seem to work. And so we have better insights into how to reopen schools, which are so critical for school children's development, in ways that are safer.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's interesting about the sort of the evidence that is accruing and what's coming out. And there still seems to be some disagreement about the role that children play in transmission and whether there's a sort of relationship between severity of the disease and how potentially, you know, therefore likely you are to transmit it to others. I.e. if children get milder immune response, are they more or less likely to be infectious? What's your reading of the evidence and what that sort of what the implications are?
I use this opportunity to ask a good friend and colleague, Kathy Edwards, who's a pediatrician and infectious disease expert, about this, because I too had a lot of questions. I thought the evidence was a little bit conflicting. And what she told me is that several studies have now shown that the viral loads in children and adults are comparable, but there's an apparently reduced contagiousness in younger children, and that's not yet well explained. She said there are some theories. For example, there's a theory that it's due to children having less forceful coughs or things like that, but it's just really not clear. So again, I say when we don't know something, what do we know and how can we use that information? So what we do know is that children, adolescents, and young adults can get sick from COVID-19, and they can transmit it even if at lower rates, and even if younger children are more likely to be asymptomatic. So what we should do is that we should practice physical distancing, mask wearing, hand washing, and self-isolating of children who've been exposed to infected people or who are known to be infected. So we can do things even though we don't have all the answers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's, you know, been the sort of situation throughout the virus, is that people are, you know, we're struggling to get our heads around the different bits of evidence that are coming out and what that means practically about how we live our lives and obviously the huge implications that has for people who don't have a voice, you know, like children. So what do you think the sort of evidence that we need now to kind of inform policymakers more and to make them feel more confident about the decisions that they're making. You know, I feel like in the UK, we've kind of got to the point where we've pretty much decided that primary schools and secondary schools should remain open. You know, we still have real issues with university outbreaks and how that's been managed. So what do you think it is that we need so that people can feel more confident about the types of decisions they're having to make?
In Boston, in the Northeast U.S., they've just paused their plans to reopen schools because their test positivity rate went up. So what I think is important is to state in advance something like criteria or a tiering system, then make decisions when the data tell you that conditions on the ground have shifted, as they did in Boston, and then learn from what other places are doing about what works, and then adjust either your criteria or your response to different levels of these things. And this is just going to have to be a continual learning process. We don't know everything we need to know to do this perfectly, so we just need to be data driven and then adjust when new evidence comes out.
Yeah, and I guess that's the really hard thing, particularly when we're talking about children and adolescence, which spans now for such a long period of time. You know, our understanding of adolescence goes up to kind of 24 or 25, and I suppose that's where I'm interested to see what happens with the cutoff. You know, when do we start thinking that actually physiologically within how they respond to COVID-19 and perhaps how they are transmitting it within a community, we decide that they're more like adults and therefore need to be treated more like adults rather than saying, okay, well, you can still go to school. And all of those kind of things seem extremely difficult to kind of untangle and to feel confident about. So it does seem such a difficult situation.
It does. But one of the things that has been discussed a lot in the U.S. context, and in fact, there are some estimates about it, is, of course, children live in households with adults. So when you talk about sending children back to school in person, then you are talking about potentially exposing the adults in their household as well as the adults who are professionals in those schools. And so really a key part of this decision that I don't think is getting enough attention is that we have to make judgments about the risk to communities, not just to children in schools. And so I think there may be a dichotomy there about cutoffs and thresholds and things like that. That's not considering the whole context in which children live. And so, for example, there have been estimates of the proportion of children that live in households where there's someone who might be at high risk due to being immune compromised, obese, having heart conditions, and it may be as many as half of US children.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And then there's all the other knock-on implications to kind of think about, you know, whether parents are then able to work and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It kind of goes on, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
You touched briefly about Boston, but maybe you could just sort of summarize the situation in the US at the moment with regards to schools being open and universities and what's happening. As far as you know, obviously you can't kind of tell us each state and each place, but broadly.
Yes. So broadly speaking, there are just a few of the larger school systems in the U.S. that are starting to open. So, for example, New York is starting to open, New York City. Obviously, they were hard hit early in the pandemic. They are opening, though, under a situation where they're doing very extensive testing. They are watching numbers very closely and ready to shut down schools, classes, things like that. In contrast, in Miami-Dade, I don't think they're opening with exactly the same level of testing, contact tracing, and other things that need to go hand in hand. And they're seeing more cases. Again, though, there are many, many large school districts, for example, San Francisco, just not even going to open it before 2021. So there's really a wide variation across the U.S. in what's going on. Here in Nashville, we just started reopening the schools last week.
Wow, yeah. So it just seems to be sort of just disproportionate kind of effects to different people, just sort of postcode lottery, as we would call it here almost.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of broadening it more out now to think globally, I mean, it seems to me that the measurements and data of which countries are able to provide some level of education during the pandemic seems to be a little bit lacking. I know that UNICEF have been trying to monitor this and do sort of create reports. But what's your understanding of how we might be able to get a sort of better grip on the global situation of education for young people?
Yes. I would say that, you know, although I think it's UNESCO who has a nice tool, the data are lacking, not just globally, but within countries, even within districts, about what is exactly is going on. So example, for example, here in Tennessee, the vast majority of districts are having what they're calling a hybrid model, where parents can choose whether to send their children in person or have them do remote learning. We don't have that kind of information globally. We don't know how much time children are actually spending in the classroom. We don't know if they have the right tools to be doing remote learning, if that's the choice made on their behalf. There's so much we don't know, even if we have some rough measure of what schools are theoretically open or closed, because open and closed just isn't enough. There's quality of extra education, there's models of education and things like that. So I am very worried that we're not collecting these data systematically, and thus we're really not going to know the impact on children and be able to figure out ways to ameliorate what is certainly going to be some kind of loss this year.
Totally. And I suppose that takes us on to the next question kind of quite nicely that I wanted to talk about, which is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the sort of many vulnerable groups that are feeling the impact of COVID-19. But you do seem to be kind of particularly sort of affected, both, you know, physically, mentally, educationally, economically and socially, potentially for years to come in terms of, you know, the sort of long term economic consequences for them. What are your sort of real concerns, and how do you think we can give young people a sort of better voice in this and sort of have them more as a priority?
Yes. So my colleague Kyle Gaviakal and I wrote a piece in the JAMA Health Forum about this very question. And we cited a lot of literature about children's worsened mental health, reduced access to nutritious foods, and how this might be these adverse effects are being experienced by underserved communities disproportionately. So we thought about reopening schools should start with the groups most likely to be disadvantaged by the pandemic, and based on recommendations. So for example, K-5 students may be the least able to, primary students may be least able to learn remotely. Children with disabilities may need extra and in-person help. Children who are already behind grade level might be specially targeted. Families that don't have access to the internet or ability to do remote learning, which may include low-income families who are at risk of eviction, for example. And then there's a whole group of youth who are in home environments that causes greater concern. For example, LGBTQ youth may be in a home environment that's not conducive to learning. And one of my colleagues has recently been writing about that in the context of college students who may be staying at home. So all these groups, I think we should think carefully about them and how do we bring them back in person safely and quickly. But we also, as you just said, we need to listen to children. And in particular, if we're going to bring kids back to a safe environment, it's going to have to be different than what they're used to. They're going to need to wear masks. They're going to need to social distance. And so we need the voices of students to figure out how to make this socially acceptable, how to make this part of a school culture where they can all be safe and keep each other safe. And if we don't listen to kids about how to do that, we definitely won't get it right.
Yeah, exactly. And they won't be able to enjoy it, you know. I mean, it's school when it's at its best is such a sort of wonderful time. My son's gone to preschool now and he is adoring it. So, you know, to think that he would be missing out on that experience is so sad. You know, that sort of whole kind of mental development is so crucial.
I was talking to a friend of mine the other day and she was talking about her 5-year-old who is dressed up at 5 in the morning every morning to go to school. She can't believe how excited she is to finally be allowed to go to school.
Yeah. Exactly, you know. And I think it's going to be so funny about this sort of narrative that they look back on when they're 90, you know, when they're in their 80s and 90s looking back on this period of time. It will be fascinating to see what they see it as. I think my son will probably see it as quite a kind of peaceful, quiet time, but a very strange one. We also spoke with Innes Hassan, policy researcher at the Global Health Governance Programme at the University of Edinburgh and the main contact for the UK school pandemic policy in the Royal Society's DELVE initiative, which feeds its work into the UK government and SAGE.
So I'm a senior policy researcher at the Global Health Governance Programme at the University of Edinburgh. And I also have a longer background working for healthcare. Started off as a biochemical engineer, worked for many years in kind of the broader healthcare industry. And I'm also a member of the DELV Data Evaluation for Viral Epidemics group, which was set up by the Royal Society at the start of the pandemic. So we've been working with them very closely, trying to develop rapid policy recommendations with regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. I was assigned schools and looking at how the health of children in schools and how that might possibly impact the transmission rates kind of in the wider community as well. I also do consulting work for the World Health Organization as well.
Great. So you're very well placed to be talking to us at the moment, because in the UK, we are just about to enter another lockdown. Schools are to remain open. Initially, we thought that, the evidence that we had to close schools, my understanding is at the beginning of the last lockdown, was sort of based on flu, where we think that closing schools can kind of make a meaningful role in reducing transmission. But we now think that because of the sort of transmission dynamics of COVID-19 in children, that closing schools might not be that effective. And the sort of disadvantages, of keeping children at home and not having education outweigh the advantages. Although, obviously the jury's still out. What is the strength of evidence that we have now about whether children should be going to school or staying home?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really tricky one. I mean, one fact that I always remember, that I think in August, there was an estimate that 1 billion children were thought to be out of school across the globe, and roughly 400 million of them had lost access to free school meals, and also a much publicized problem we have in the UK as well. So I think there are also many other health considerations, such as physical education, mental health, long-term loss of skills and earnings to consider. So it isn't just so easy to kind of to close a school. So I think we need to kind of always remember that. Also, it's important to remember that transmission of COVID-19 remains low in schools if, and that's a big if, that community transmission is low. So as we've seen experiences in countries like Israel and several states in the US, they've shown that if cases jump quickly and community transmission is high, then it's very difficult to keep schools open safely. You get continual outbreaks and cases of COVID-19 in schools, which also then obviously affect the confidence of the wider community, teachers and parents, even if the risk is kind of relatively low compared to kind of other areas. We even had a report, I think, earlier in the year, in August, I think it was, from Public Health England, which examined the outbreaks of COVID-19 at English schools in June. And they found a very strong correlation between the number of school outbreaks and the regional incidence of COVID-19. And I think this is also reflected in more recent stats with regards to school attendance. So it's an issue, but there's lots that we can do. And I think that the ultimate recommendation that we gave, especially as a DELV group that we gave to the government, is that kind of the last thing that should close and the first thing that should open are our schools, because of all these broader disadvantages that are associated with school closures. Breaking chains of transmissions after cases emerge in schools is incredibly important. And I think we've emphasized this again and again, but the thing that's really important is having a robust testing and tracing system, which is really integrated well within community. And one of the things that's important is that these sort of tracking and tracing and testing systems, they work especially well when community transmission levels are manageable. So they need to be kind of low enough. The other thing also to consider is that we know that older kids and teenagers, they can transmit, and some studies have shown the same levels as adults. So we have seen that evidence that there are older teen infection rates rising substantially since schools have opened. So just to re-emphasize the point that we need infections low enough that the risk in schools do not rise so much within this particular age group as well. But the other thing to also note is that they also probably more likely to catch it out of school, so where they're socialising. So perhaps something like a lockdown would also help. Another important point is that what we really need to do is stop conflating schools with universities. Those are two very different environments, and we as a group in DELV, we recommended that schools go back, but we did not recommend that universities go back. Yeah. I think universities are a completely different environment, and the kind of the disadvantages of not opening universities universities are not the same as not opening schools. You know, it's completely different. And also the universities are very much responsible for spread, not necessarily through kind of the education areas, kind of in lecture halls, but primarily in accommodation, of course.
Yeah.
Especially because, of course, people had been coming from different parts of the country. So, you know, more readily kind of increasing the risk of transmission. So I think that's something we really need to emphasize. The government really needs to stop talking about schools and universities as one. They are completely different.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That narrative is so wrong, isn't it? Because, you know, they're just the two completely different kettles of fish. And to a large part, you're talking about adults really getting together, you know, in terms of sort of actual sort of physiology and how they're dealing with the disease. You're talking about adults getting together in a large place and kind of, you know, coming from various parts of the country and living together, you know, so it is a completely different ballgame, it seems.
A completely different ballgame, 100%. And also just to remember the negative aspects of them not being university. Yes, it's, you know, detrimental, but just not to the same extent as we are seeing with schools. And the last point I want to make is that the MPIs that we have, the different interventions that we can use to reduce the risk of transmissions, they do work. So let's use all of them. You know, we recommended in our report that masks are worn in schools, but from, you know, they were never made mandatory in schools. And even from what I hear from teachers is that some schools, they're not allowed to wear masks. So wearing of masks, we encourage the proper use of proper testing, you know, where even asymptomatic cases can also be measured, would really make a huge difference. I know in places like Scotland, they prioritized at the beginning when schools first started to open, they prioritized on-demand testing for teachers, nurseries and other school staff who thought that they might have been exposed to the virus. That could also help. And then the use of wearing masks as well. So anything that we're not using, because all of these MPIs will almost like have a group of like a tools, you know, that all of them will help reduce the risk.
They have a cumulative effect.
Exactly, a cumulative effect.
That's what our paper that we published, you know, way back in March showed about all of these different, you know, masks, social distancing, eyewear, everything, you know, has a cumulative effect. And that's, I think that's what we often forget, isn't it? That it's that sort of, you know, the group of measures that can really push things down percentage by percentage.
Exactly. So they're all cumulatively can have an effect. And I think one of the important things to remember is it's very difficult to know exactly what the effect of a single MPI might be versus another, because sometimes it's unethical to kind of carry out these types of studies. Obviously, like a scientist, we would love there to be, you know, a randomly controlled trial where, what, you know, one set of children wore masks, the other didn't wear masks. Yeah. You know, obviously, that's unethical, so we can't do it. Because we know keeping schools open is so important, because we know the detrimental effects of closing are so important, you know, we need to do everything possible just to try to kind of cover our bases. And then the last point related to that is that we need to ensure that schools have the right resourcing to make sure that they can use all of these interventions, you know, but things like, for example, we've mentioned masks a lot, but also because we need to keep the airflow, you know, and not every school will have good ventilation. So, of course, what we'll want them to do is keep windows open. But as we get closer to winter, it's getting colder and colder. So what else do we need to do? What do we need to think out of the box? Like, do we need to make sure kids have appropriate clothing? Do we need to bring in blankets? All those kind of extra things need to be considered to ensure we can implement all of those MPIs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that kind of takes me on to my next question about this sort of natural experiment that's going on now, because, you know, one of the key issues, and, you know, public health specialists have been saying it from the very beginning, as soon as, you know, we started going into this situation in early March, the key is going to be to try and understand which NPIs are most effective and when they should be placed and all the rest of it. And disentangling that seems so difficult. So sort of in terms of, almost a natural experiment that's going on now in the UK in terms of keeping those schools open, how best should we be monitoring this over the next 4 weeks so that we can understand what the contribution is and try and, you know, really get some clarity on it? Because this may not be the last time that we have to, you know, be in this sort of situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one of the pieces of advice we gave before schools reopened in August is that what we really need to do is we need to assess the outcome from schools relative to the counterfactual. So what would have happened to local infection rates if schools had remained closed? And so to do this, we said it required testing of pupils who were at school and those who were at home, because at the time we had, you know, some primary school children back in school, some at home. So we didn't really take the advantage of that particular opportunity. But there have been some studies. So the Public Health England did run the COVID surveillance in kids program as a kind of proof of concept study that aimed just to test staff and schools, I think in about 100 schools in the summer. And a kind of an initial analysis of that data collection protocol suggested that it would not have been conclusively, we wouldn't have been able to conclusively demonstrate a difference in the risk for attending schools, even if the risk was double that of non-attendance. And I think that was because the sample size was too low at the time, and because they'd only tested children kind of attending school and not those out of school. So a case control study of children both in school and not in school would have allowed us to compare attending school effects what the difference is, and we would really be able to see if like a school is actually a source of kind of transmission. So kind of expanding that potentially could be useful, although now most all of the children are kind of back in school, so that could have been a useful study. There are like some there were some plans for kind of further studies to happen, but again, the ethical questions have come into play. So there's a few kind of stumbling blocks. I think the ethics of collecting samples, one of kind of the approaches they wanted to use was collect samples but not test them for a few weeks to observe asymptomatic transmission. I'm not involved in these studies, but from what I've discussed with colleagues, and I think the ethics of that was questioned. And also they carried out some focus groups, which has suggested that parents actually and head teachers and unions would have been happy to do this. But there was also some hesitancy to subject children to repeated testing. So I think what we wanted to do is continually test children, you know, to see, because obviously we know most children are asymptomatic, especially in primary school children, to see when they do become positive and how quickly that they might kind of the disease might be transmitted throughout the school. But there was hesitancy to subject those children to repeated swab testing. So perhaps there are like a few less intrusive tests which are being explored, so that potentially might make things a little bit easier.
It's interesting, isn't it, to see how that will play out, because certainly, you know, for the rest of the winter, this is such a crucial issue. We all want to see schools, well, we don't all want to see schools keeping open, but many people do want to see schools open and the kids able to go. And keeping that seems to be, you know, one of the key things that we need to get on top of and really understand the evidence behind it and get some really strong data. So it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It's a difficult one, but also because we are going to be in lockdown, so hopefully fewer people kind of within the wider community will need to be tested. And if we can still prioritise the children, the teachers in that time where hopefully less of us will be kind of infected with COVID-19, then that would also be a good use, because, you know, really understanding how asymptomatic transmission works is incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. We spoke to Rosanna Peeling about this sort of thorny issue of testing. We've spoken a little bit about it already. You've mentioned it and highlighted how crucial it is to the sort of overall end game. And we sort of discussed this need for high-income countries that are sort of currently struggling with testing to pivot away from highly accurate tests to one that can be done more frequently and more easily. And in Liverpool, we're just seeing this sort of mass testing strategy coming out. Could you tell us your thoughts on this and again, how this relates to schools? I mean, we've already said that we need to prioritise school testing and teachers and children, but how this might change over the winter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually glad to see that mass testing is being explored in Liverpool. I think the cost-benefit analysis for screening of asymptomatic pupils is complicated, but on balance, I'd also recommend it. So I think routine testing is important. One thing I didn't also mention before, I think it was estimated that COVID transmission is estimated to account, so asymptomatic COVID transmission is estimated to account for 40% of community transmission, and possibly more in school-age children. So just to emphasize, that's sort of incredibly important. The other thing to remember is that to bring infections down more quickly than in the original lockdown, you know, mass testing could really help, especially in areas where there's high daily incidence and a higher R number, as being seen in places, cities like Liverpool. Otherwise, there's a risk that it will take even longer to kind of bring infection rates down. When mass testing is done using both PCR tests and lateral flow tests, as being done in Liverpool, you need to bear in mind that a negative result from a lateral flow test is not a guarantee that they're free from infection. So as lateral flow tests are, I think, around 20% less sensitive than PCR tests, so they still need to follow things, the other kind of interventions like social distancing, even if you get a negative result.
Yeah.
But the great benefit of mass testing is being able to quickly identify lots of people who are infected so that they can be asked to self-isolate immediately, thereby breaking chains of transmission. And if you find one positive case in, for example, a group of people, then you can use more expensive tests to try and really find out, you know, who is really positive. But I think it's a great development, and I'm glad to see that we're starting to use those sorts of tests.
In the UK, schools keeping open over lockdown is quite controversial at the moment, and there seems to be a major divide between some of the teachers' unions who feel that it's not safe for teachers and some parents who are worried that it's not safe, but many parents who feel that this is the best thing for children to try and keep some sense of education and to not disadvantage them too much.
When you look at it in those terms, it's quite a holistic measure almost, keeping the schools open, isn't it? Because it's a kind of, it's something that has these whole life effects on a child. And even missing a few months of school can have these kind of deleterious knock-on effects that are felt years later, decades later, later in life. But it is quite difficult to express that in the face of something as obviously dangerous as a pandemic.
You know, again, going back to the sort of inequality, digital divide, you know, wealthy families being able to be quite comfortable at home with fast Wi-Fi, and they've got parents who can do homeschooling or whatever, have hot food, meals, food, you know, it does seem in many ways to be the fairest thing to keep schools open.
But that does also touch on something that Inez was talking about with you in that interview, which is that these school closures have a massive impact on the more disadvantaged children, you know, the ones that rely on the free school meals. And obviously there are going to be many, many households across the country that simply aren't going to have the equipment to connect to the school for lessons.
Exactly. So I do feel that the evidence has sort of accumulated sufficiently. You know, obviously we're not 100% certain, but I do think that there has been accumulating evidence that closing schools is different for COVID-19 than it is to flu, where it can be very effective. You know, in 2009, and I think we have seen very effective use of closing schools in previous sort of epidemics and pandemics. But for COVID-19, I do think that the evidence is at a state where we can probably say for now school staying open is safe. And I think that one of Melinda's points and Innes's points, you know, they make two great points. And one of it is that the narrative shouldn't be around keeping schools open, you know, is it a risk, but about minimizing the risk so that we can keep schools open. And I think the other thing is this issue of universities and schools and not lumping them all together, because it's ridiculous to lump them all together. It's a completely, you know, they're completely different sort of setups, completely different adults and children. It's very hard to put them all together. But I feel that at the moment, that is the narrative, that they're all lumped together.
But I would like to express extraordinary amounts of sympathy for the first year of university students currently in the UK.
Oh, God,
who faced the A-level results problems over the summer and then went straight into student halls. And many of them ended up locked in the student halls, zooming into their lectures. It's for that one particular year, of students. It's been the most unbelievable few months that's going to affect them for years to come.
Well, I think there is also evidence that those children or those adults that start universities or going through universities as you go into a recession bear the brunt of that recession for decades to come in terms of their, you know, earnings and their job opportunities. So it is extremely hard for that age group.
And I think what we're getting at here is something that's really important to bear in mind is that there's no good solutions. There's not one solution that's going to tackle everything. These are all bad outcomes. It's just a case of balancing the bad outcomes you're prepared to bear with the ones that you're not.
Yeah, and obviously at the moment we're looking at it from children's point of view, but there are also teachers. And I think there has been some evidence to suggest that, you know, teachers have got infected, you know, fairly frequently in many settings of schools. And obviously that's an incredibly important issue. You know, these are vital people in our society. So it's again, all about this sort of balancing the risks. And I think for now, in the UK at least, all we can do is really try and monitor it and set up a system where we can try and disentangle this relationship of schools and how it plays into transmission of COVID-19.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lancet Voice. We'll see you again next time.